Let's open with a word of prayer. Father, we still our hearts before you. We could never thank you enough that we have actually information about you to study. That you broke into history and revealed your heart and your beauty and your love for us and your care and your shepherd quality. Your interest in the minutiae of our life and the big things of our life. We thank you that you did not leave us in ignorance and darkness, but you actually put a face on and came and walked among us as your Son, the Lord Jesus, so long ago that our hands have touched and we've fellowshipped at the table, and these people have shared that experience down through your Bible and your prophets and things of this type. And we just thank you for caring enough to reveal your heart to us. And we just pray that we would respond to your sort of trust in us and sharing who you are with us, that we might respond in kind. As you take the leadership in our relationship, that we might be responsive to such beauty and such openness and such honesty and givingness, that we might become more like you, but at the same time, Father, that we might become more thrilled by your love and calmed by your acceptance and find our hearts at peace before you more and more. So we ask that you bless this time and all the hearts here tonight, that we would come away with a greater appreciation for what this immense thing you did so long ago, and that we could see things more clearly as your great grace peeks out through the pages of the New Testament in our lives. We ask this for your Son's sake, that we might fall more in love with him. Amen. This is where the little red rectangle. Just to let you know, I'm running about 2 quarts low health-wise tonight, so I'll be talking a little slower for the first 3 minutes, and then we'll crank up to normal speed. So if I'm a little slower, you'll understand why. The red rectangle there is where most of biblical history occurred, up from the book of Genesis, actually Genesis 12. You have Genesis 1 through 12, there's a good possibility Genesis 1 through 11 occurs more in this space than the others. The ark is said to have landed somewhere roughly in there. We don't know the exact location, Noah's ark. The Garden of Eden is said to be, through all the rumors and various trajectories there, is somewhere in this space here, roughly, or was. A lot of cataclysmic changes because of the flood. There are cities in here named, various cities up in this Turkey and Iran there in northern Syria that are named after, and they have these names going back as far as you can see, Peleg, and names in the old Genesis genealogies, and Joktan, and things that are just so far away we have no records of it apart from Scripture. And their names that have, and they don't ever change the names of anything over there, period. I mean, it's always, you know, a name, then they give you a modern version, but that old name sticks. And so there's a good chance that some of the earlier parts of Genesis, Genesis 1 through 11, might have occurred in a little bit wider area than that. But from Genesis 12, the call of Abraham, through Acts chapter 5, 6, 7, somewhere in that space, all of biblical history occurs, most of biblical history occurs within that little red rectangle. Okay, and when we zoom in on that, we see the Fertile Crescent, and this is where we've, we'll be concentrating on that. Let me get one more thing here. And remember, Abraham is, actually Abraham is probably from up north in this area of the world. He's probably, there's a town up here called Haran. And he was from a wealthy family that's probably up in that area. They were Arameans. In Deuteronomy, the Jews had a creed that they had to state, my father was a wandering Aramean. And the Arameans, at the time of Abraham, lived up in the north of the Tigris-Euphrates rivers. And of course, this is our Tigris-Euphrates rivers. And there's a good chance that the family of Abraham, before he was born, moved down to the richest city in the world on the coastline, Ur. Ur is also means city. So we're not really sure, you know, whether it's the city of, you say the Ur of Ur, or what. But it's Ur. Ur of, it's called later Ur of the Chaldees, But the Chaldees weren't actually there until much, much later. But so he's at the city of Ur in Sumeria, you know, the oldest civilization that we have. God, they start moving north. They decide there's some events that occur in the 2000 to 1800 space in world history, which is when Abraham is there, that makes it more lucrative for them to leave the city that had just been conquered and to move perhaps back home. And so they decide not necessarily to go home, but the father, Terah, welcome. There'll be another binder there. A couple of chairs over there. And then his dad, Terah is a worshiper of the moon deity. Terah worships, is a pagan. He's a polytheist, according to Scripture. Abraham is not. But he is, and there were two main centers of moon worship. One was Ur, and the other was Haran. And so they make, a several hundred mile trek up the Tigris-Euphrates, and the father intends to go all the way over into Canaan, because Canaan is up and coming in terms of money and commerce and stuff like that. There's a lot happening over there. People have been moving from the west to the east, taking over Samaria and things of this type. So, and they're vaguely kinfolk. They're a Semite. But they get somewhere up this, and the father, Abraham's father, decides, well, nah, forget this. We're not going to go there. We're just going to go back to our homeland and Haran. So instead of cutting across like they would have had they really were going into Canaan, they continued up to Haran. And at Haran, there's a couple of places that are very, very famous, too, in terms of antiquity. But after God appears to Abram somewhere during this journey and says, leave your father's household, all this wealth that you've accumulated. They were very wealthy. They were a very wealthy family, as it turns out. Leave your father's household, all this stuff, and travel to a land that I will show you, which is the land of Palestine. So Abram and his wife, Sarai, they leave and they go, and Lot, his nephew, there's a whole entourage that goes with him. You never traveled alone. He would have already had servants, you know, household servants, butlers, cooks, you know, military guards. He would have had interpreters, you know, all the things you'd have to do commerce and live in the land. So he goes into the land of Palestine to, which is this area, the next part of biblical history is going to occur in that little circle, which we're going to expand to that. So here's our Mediterranean Sea up there. And here's the Dead Sea. And there's, of course, the Sea of Galilee way up there, that little spot. And this is where all the Exodus is going to occur here. Here's the beautiful Nile Delta. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are going to grow up in the land. They're going to learn to speak the local dialect. Abram is called a prince among the people. There's this war that goes on, five kings against four, and one of the local Hittite folks says, you are a prince among us. They use a special title that was used of governors back then. So he might have been in some kind of official capacity. And so he has some responsibility for the land, even though he doesn't own a scrap of it. And he goes out and rescues And he does a couple of trips. He does a trip with a famine. He goes down to Egypt. He goes to Abimelech. And these are rulers that treat him as a peer. So Pharaoh accepts him into the house as an equal. You know, they're governors together. Same thing with Abimelech, the king of the area that later was dominated by the Philistines. Accepts him as an equal. They have a reciprocity covenant, things of this type. So he's very well off, but he doesn't own a scrap of land. He's got everything going for him there, and he has no heir because of that story about his the barrenness of Sarah until the very end. Well, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they go in the land. We have that situation where Jacob, who later becomes Israel, renamed Israel, he has the 12 sons, right? One of whom is Joseph, who's going to save the world, right? Joseph gets sold into slavery by his brothers to his kinfolk, Ishmaelite. And Ishmael is his great-grandfather, I guess it would be his father, would be a sort of like a great-grandfather, except he was He was not in the inheritance line. He was the son of a concubine, which means you didn't have inheritance rights, as opposed to the son of the wife. That was the difference between concubines and wives, was whether their children could inherit the property or not. The patriarch would give them gifts constantly, but in terms of actually deeding the land and all the material possessions, that would go somewhere else. But these are Ishmaelites who broke off. They live over here on this side, up in this. They're slave traders in this particular case. They're on their way for a caravan to Egypt. They sell Joseph in. Joseph, of course, gets sold into slavery. We have that story of him rising to authority, you know, in an official's house, Potiphar's house. He gets thrown into prison by blackmail and some shady doings. He spends a couple of years in prison. And then because he can tell the future and is a good administrator, he gets exalted to be the right-hand man of Pharaoh. So he then saves the whole Middle East, actually, through the 7 years of famine and the 7 years of plenty story. Okay? Now, so Joseph now is ruler in Egypt. He then goes back and fetches his family because the famine is really bad up here in Israel and Palestine. So he brings all the rest of the Israelites, his family rather, the Abrahamites, I guess they'd be called, and they live in the land of Egypt. They have their own land there. It's not just them. Archaeology points out they were mixed in with other people from what's called Asia. There were a number of different groups there. They weren't all Asian. I mean, they weren't all Israelites. They would have also been a number of other Asian, you know, Phoenicians, Philistines, Canaanites, then people from Saudi Arabia. You know, it was a mixed multitude that would have been there. Some Egyptians moved there. Lower class Egyptians moved there. So when the Exodus occurs and they cross the Red Sea, probably somewhere right in that neck of the woods, what comes out is not just all the descendants of Abraham. We get what the Scripture calls a mixed multitude. And some of the older translations calls them a rabble. Right? A rabble. And so the Exodus occurs. Moses brings them out. They go here to Sinai, somewhere in this area, this mountainous area. They get the Ten Commandments. They get some of the other legislation. They go to get the promised land that God had promised Abraham. And the Israelites won't play with the program. Not only did they not play with the program, they slander God among, 1,000,006 people. About obviously, he doesn't care enough for us. And they're going to slander him for another 40 years. You know, did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us in the wilderness because there were no graves in Egypt? You know, I mean, they're gonna take some, you know, interesting positions there. But eventually, Moses is going to lead them through up here through the King's Highway. They're going to come in right in here, and at that particular point, the rest of the story concentrates right here. So the rest of the story is the land of Palestine. When Moses gets there, when Moses brings them up around about this way, roughly, they're camped out here across from Jericho, which is right roughly there, a little bit further north than that. And that's where the leadership changes from Moses to Joshua. Okay, so at that point, Moses doesn't get to go in the promised land because of some a big mistake he made in front of 1,000,006 people. And so it passes to Joshua. And just as and Joshua is still a young man here. He's maybe in the 50s. He's maybe 50, 50, 60s. They had 40 years in the wilderness, and he was young. So he'd be, you know, he was in the 18 or 20 probably. So that puts him in the 58, 60 category, something like that. Moses, of course, is over 100 years old at this particular point. Passes the leadership. Joshua and them go in to the land. The land, Joshua then, they take the high ground. Remember we talked about the, we didn't do our mantra, did we? So how far is it from the north, tip of the Dead Sea to the Sea of Galilee? From Greenville to, this one's Winona. That's the longer one. That's Winona. And then from the Dead Sea to the Mediterranean Sea is from Greenville to Greenwood. Right, so it's very, very small, very, very small area. The Sea of Galilee, well, anyway. All right, so that's our area there. We move to, that's where the modern countries are now. So Syria, Jordan, the West Bank, Jerusalem, relative to the Dead Sea. So everything's very, very close in there. Part of Lebanon used to be Israel, part of Syria, and the Jordan, Transjordan used to be part of, you know, ancient Israel, but they're not now. Okay, there was our map about the distances that we just talked about, Greenville, Greenwood, and that's, like I say, in your handout, we've covered this. Now, when they went in as one nation, the nation of Israel, but remember there were 12 sons. Jacob had 12 sons, right? And the 12 sons are allotted 12 areas of land except Levi. Levi, one of the 12 tribes, is selected out to be a teachers. And so they're the ones that are going to keep the law. They're the ones that are going to do all the writing and the scribes and make copies of the law. And they're going to be the sort of the administrators. They're going to be the scholars. They're going to be in charge of teaching. They're going to be in charge of liturgy, doing a ritual, doing feasts and festivals. That's their job. And so they're going to spread through the other 11 tribes to try to keep everybody on the same program. Okay, and it's always... they're specially placed throughout the land. So there's no reason why this shouldn't have worked because the distribution was right. So there's where you can see where the 12 tribes are there. Now, what ends up happening is that the 12 tribes do sort of well until they don't like the government. So we have the three kings. Saul is the first king, united mark of all the land. Saul is selected, remember, because he's the tallest and somebody's got to die in the battle with the Philistines. And so why not Saul? And so he's picked as the military leader. Saul, and God offered Saul an entire dynasty if Saul would just work with the program. And Saul didn't work with the program, so he picked somebody that was better qualified because he had a shepherd's heart. So the shepherd doesn't let the single sheep go. They go out there, they'll... you know, have somebody stay with the 99 and they'll go out and find the thistle and the thorns, the little sheep that's bleeding, and bring him back in. Whereas the other ones will do what we would call acceptable losses. You know, would sit there and say, you know, well, it's only five. I got enough extra money on my paycheck. I'll reimburse the owner for them. You know, it's not that big a deal. But David had a shepherd's heart. He was very brave. One of the problems that you have in the land of Israel are lions. You have a lot of lions, and they'll just go in there and attack your, you know, take away your lamb. God uses this as an example later of the when the Assyrians are going to come in and take away the northern kingdom of Israel. He'd say their devastation is going to be so bad that you know how when a lion comes and gets a shepherd. I mean, the lion comes and gets a sheep. They always like leave one hoof behind, or you know, an ear. You know, they don't take it all off, but it's all going to be gone for the little Israelites. So the 12 tribes of Israel, they scatter. So the land is breaks up with Solomon. So we got Saul, David, Solomon. Solomon's fairly decent, but he starts bringing in all these foreign gods. He makes these political marriages. Each one of his political wives from another kingdom wants to set up, you know, their own little church to worship their little deity from Moab or Ammon or wherever. Some of those deities were very, very bad, and that's the reason God, you know, evicted the previous tenants from the land and pushed them out to the edge. It's an interesting archaeological study that I've got up on the tank that when Israel goes in, all of a sudden, wham, a million people appear out on the outside. God didn't actually exterminate the Canaanites. He drove them out. He said, I will send the hornet ahead of you and drive them out. You will see their backs as they run away. The ones that are stupid enough to stay in the cities, they're your problems. And those are the ones I won't take it out. But at least a million people fled. Only 10,000 roughly, maybe 10 to 20,000 actually fought the Israelites and lost their lives in that process. So they move in, everything moves out. So the bad gods go out with the people, theoretically. And then here comes along Solomon and says, hey, let's do this treaty. Let's do a treaty. Yes, I'll marry the princess, and you're marrying the prince, and you know, we'll do this thing. Yeah, I know you need to worship the way you worship, and sure, we'll have a child sacrifice site right over here east of Jerusalem. So it's just east of Jerusalem in the hill of Slaughter, I think it was named by the later rabbis. They had this Molech, the god of the Ammonites, that you did child sacrifice. A particularly horrible form, actually. But that's another story to be told at another time. So Solomon has a divided mind, so God says, okay, well, your kingdom splits. And it splits right here. And all these up here are the 10 tribes of Israel. And down here, there's sort of two tribes, roughly speaking. There's Judah and Simeon, that's already disappeared. It's sort of just gotten in there already. So it divides up into what we call the divided monarchy. The northern kingdom, Israel, is going to be carried away in... They turn bad first, and most rapidly. And so they're under the same covenant treaty with God that says, I will protect you as long as you even show the slightest interest in me. Just any kind of impulse toward good, I will protect you from all these foreign powers. You won't even have to fight. You'll have to march out as a sign of faith, but you won't even have to fight. But if you don't, then here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do this, and then if you don't listen to that, I'm going to talk a little louder. Don't listen to that, talk a little louder. We'll keep going until we get to the... When you're as worse than the people in the land that I kicked out, then I'll kick you out too. But I will not forsake you. I will bring you back when your heart goes in the right direction. So Israel gets carried off to Assyria, the nation of the empire of Assyria, in 722 B.C. Okay, little Judah is going to be conquered by Babylon in 586 B.C. Between 722 and 586, guess who conquered who? Right? The Babylonians conquered the Assyrians much earlier than that, right? And at that point, when we have the Babylonian captivity, when the Jews are over, the northern kingdom is just scattered, the kingdom come. They can still trace their lineage. They've still got genealogical records. One of the ladies when Jesus comes to the temple, when Mary and Joseph bring the baby Jesus to the temple for the christening, it's a little anachronistic, but for the presentation that every firstborn male had to go there, one of the prophetess Anna, looks at it, and Anna is from the tribe of Asher, which is one of the northern tribes. So there are people all the way through Israelite history that can still trace their lineage to one of those quote-unquote lost 10 tribes of Israel. There's still people that can do that today. Judah goes over. The land is vacant at this particular point until the period between the Old Testament and the New. Cities in the cities that we're looking at, tonight we get into Nazareth. Nazareth, of course, is where he's going to grow up in Nazareth, right? One of his early rejections is going to occur at Nazareth. Bethlehem down here, of course, is where he's going to be born, right? He's going to be presented at Jerusalem, but we won't talk about Jerusalem until the end of the course, when we talk about the last week in Jericho and two of the miracles he did in there. So, look, Nazareth, let me back up one place here. Israel up here, the northern coast, actually gets split into two itself. So Israel is that word there, Samaria. So one of the early kings of Israel said, well, I'm tired of living here. I want to build this beautiful place in Sebas, and I'm going to call it Samaria. And so he puts this beautiful kingdom, he has a winter and a summer palaces and all this kinds of stuff. So he's in Samaria, and this area up here becomes known as Galilee. And before the 722, the Assyrians, of course, take Galilee first. So they go off another 10 years before the southern kingdom goes. So they're already, third-class citizens in this particular model. Okay, so Galilee is the area we're going to drill down on tonight. Okay, so Galilee is going to be roughly this area right about in here. And there's two Galilees. There's Upper Galilee and Lower Galilee, and it's distinguished by height. So if you look at the... We'll actually look at that in just a minute. We're almost to the little 3D thing we got to do. Lower Galilee is where Jesus grows up. He walks around. The hills aren't as high. The mountains aren't as tall. Upper Galilee starts getting into the cedars of Lebanon. You know, more formidable ranges, better hiding places, more hostile terrain. Nobody goes through there, even armies. You know, if you take the main trade routes, you control all those things. Anybody that's living in villages there, the people that are living in villages that don't come to the city, they don't have anything you want anyway as a conqueror. And so they're just like in modern warfare, you decide, you know, what your targets are that you want. So we'll look at these, hopefully we'll get two of those done tonight, maybe even. And then in the ministry of Jesus, we have Nazareth. He does do one of his opening speeches is at Nazareth. But Capernaum is the big one. There's so much history that goes on at Capernaum. Sychar is where the woman at the well, John 4, is. Jericho is a couple of miracles there. But Jericho is important to us in this context because it's on that last week, the week of the crucifixion. So he comes down to Jericho with all the Passover pilgrims that are coming down from the north to go to Jerusalem. They all suspect that he's Messiah and that maybe he's going to announce his candidacy this trip. You know, and so Jericho is where we've got a couple of things there that shows that if you look and you watch, it says, I'm not sure this is the king. This is what will end up throwing Judas maybe off. That doesn't fit sort of the stereotype of what we were sort of figuring he was the Messiah was going to be. But so we have that, and then Jerusalem, of course, is where we spent a lot of time on Jerusalem in the Easter series. But we got two miracles there that we want to talk about because we have locations for. All right, now there's our relief map of Galilee. And the main thing we pointed out here was that this, here's Jesus, there's Nazareth right there. Okay. And this is the plain of Esdraelon, where all the famous battles were fought. Remember, and this is the town of Megiddo that we get Armageddon from, right? So the main trade route comes up the city, comes up the coastline, the way of the sea. It comes through to Megiddo, and that's the pass that guards that. So everybody wants that city to guard that pass, to control the trade route for taxes, for stealing, for whatever they want to do. From there, the road breaks into three roads. One goes to Acco, Ptolemais, which is the main port city. One goes down to Beth Shean toward here, which is a Canaanite stronghold. And the other one's going to go right through here by Nazareth, not through Nazareth, up to the Sea of Galilee, and then it's going to move up to Damascus. So this is the big one. If you ever wanted to sell to Mesopotamia, that's the way you had to go. If you wanted to sell to the Greeks or up in the Aegean Sea and stuff like that, you would go across here and you'd catch it at Ptolemais and you'd sail across the Mediterranean. If you were trying to sail down in this space or across here over here, you'd go to Beth Shean. But if you wanted to sell to the largest market in the world at the time, Damascus, that's the way you went. Okay? Now we should be. Trade routes, just one thing on trade routes. I don't think you can see that very well. But that we just talked about the way of the sea. That's this thing here. See, the way of the sea comes, it crosses at Megiddo. And the main one that if you want to sell, it goes through right around Nazareth, comes into Capernaum, around Lake Huli. Sometimes you cross here, and there it goes, and there's Damascus in Syria. Okay? And there are trade routes that go. The main problem with trade routes here is that it's easy to go north and south in Palestine, but it's hard to go east and west because the mountains run north and south. So to get across, you've got to find a break in the mountain range, something that's low enough, and the easier it is to get across the mountain range, the higher the probability there are thieves there. Right? It's just direct proportionality that if you're going to travel there, there's going to be somebody waiting there with the mask on to take you of your shekels. Okay? So there are a number of trade routes that, like I say, they go in Galilee. A lot of trade routes here. Okay, now our three cities that are up in Upper Galilee. Here's that Esdraelon, the Great Plain, as I was talking about. Here, this is that valley here. Nazareth, Cana and Capernaum. Capernaum is where Jesus is going to make his headquarters. Peter, James, and John, and Andrew, and all those folks, they live there along that oast. They're all fishing business. They supply fish, apparently, to the high priest in Jerusalem. That's how John gets in and watches the trial of Jesus, because he's known to the servant, because he had done business with the high priest. So they're fairly substantial. Peter, we'll look at Peter's house when we get to that story. Peter has a much larger house than the other people in that little village. We're going to cover houses in just a few minutes, too. All right, so now I think we've got our first... Yeah, okay. Now here we are looking from the west, from the Mediterranean Sea. We're looking over at the Sea of Galilee. And there's Nazareth, right? Nazareth is up on the side of a hill. And down a little ways is Sepphoris, which we talked about last week briefly. And then Cana over here across a valley, which is where the water was turned to wine. Okay. And you see Nazareth is up on this hill range. That's a pretty high hill range there. And that distance there is about 2.5 miles from Nazareth down to Sepphoris. Sepphoris is built up on a hill. This is those main trade routes that I was talking about. You see, it just goes right by Sepphoris in Nazareth. There's a road from Nazareth that comes down somewhere in here. I can't see it on this map. It joins that road and goes over to Tiberias. And there's going to be Capernaum, where his headquarters are going to be. We're going to do one of our flyovers first. These are high-resolution satellite photographs of the land. And what we're going to do is we're going to fly up the Mediterranean coast. That's going to be Mount Hermon, very famous mountain. This is the Sea of Galilee. And then the Jordan, of course, runs that distance down to the Dead Sea, which is right there. Now, I'm going to drop the perspective. And then, okay, so you can see the land there, right? So you see right in here is the hill country. This is where the mountains, that brown is the tallest. And then this gray stuff where there's just nothing living is the wilderness of Judea. Okay, this is where Jesus will be tested for his ministry before he launches. Right after he's baptized by John the Baptist, somewhere in this space right here. I guess you see the mountain. He will go somewhere in the wilderness here. So the Dead Sea. Now what we're going to do, right here is Jerusalem. Okay, just to show you some of the... That's Jerusalem. Up here is Jericho. Well, Jericho's... You can see it here right there. 4 miles south of Jerusalem is going to be Bethlehem, which we're going to do. But right now we're going to fly up the coastline. So we're going to move over to the coast. And remember, it starts with this massive amount of the mountains here. This is what Joshua conquered. And if you'll notice right here, right below the eye, Jerusalem, see how it's sort of gray there? Looks like there's a natural break there. There is a natural break there. There's the mountain range narrows between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, which is about 4 to 6 miles below that, to a space of 2 miles or less. So it's a natural break between the stuff noise. So that's why you would put a military garrison right there at that point to eliminate traffic coming across, so you make them run uphill to fight you instead of along the hill. That's why, for example, at Bethlehem, there's a Philistine garrison. So the Philistines have a military presence there. Everybody wants a military presence there. The king, one of the kings in the divided kingdom, puts military forces there specifically because that's a border guard area. Then coming down from the mountains toward the Mediterranean, you have the hills. It just slowly slopes down to this beautiful plain of Sharon, very fertile. Everybody wants this. Not only can you farm on it, but you can fight on it with chariots. Remember, we talked about the chariots. And that's why all the battles happen here on the coast before they take you on the inland. And that's, by the way, Paul refers to this passage in Isaiah that how beautiful are the feet of those on the mountains with peaks. right? And that shows up like two or three times in the Old Testament. And that is the image of a runner coming from the battle on the plain, running up up the side of the mountain, coming in, saying, "It's okay. It's okay. They're not coming after us. We've either made peace with them, or all is well, or we won," or something of that type. So that's why the gospel, the good news of God's acceptance for us, is characterized as somebody running. The war is over with God. It's free. You know, it's simple grace by faith. You know, the war is over. It's peace. And that's why Paul uses that beautiful picture of that, because it was just from a war context. We are no longer our moral failures, our sins, our apathy, our things have been dismissed, and so the King has sought peace with us and offers us free pardon. So down here, of course, if you keep going further south, you get to Gaza, right? So this is the Gaza where the Palestinians are, and the Philistines up this coast. The Philistines lived here, and there you see Philistia, which is where we get the word Palestine from, the Philistines. Further north of them was where the Phoenicians would be. The Phoenicians are where we get our alphabet. So the Phoenicians had one of the early writers of an alphabet. They had 22 consonants, but they didn't have vowels. And so you had to really know your stuff to be able to read it. Because if you had a B there, bah, you don't know whether it's ba, bo, bi, bi, boo, whatever, unless you actually could already read. You couldn't write. You couldn't do anything. And so the little Hebrews, guess what they invent? Vowels. They say, well, look, three of these letters aren't working hard enough. Three of these consonants are not working hard enough. Why don't we just turn them into vowels too? So it'll be obvious when it's a consonant, because it'll be in between the other two consonants. All the Semitic languages have three letters in them. They start, everything starts with three letters, just boom, boom, boom. And then you build on with putting like ES and ING on the end, and you put stuff on the front, right? And so when all of a sudden there's a fourth letter in there, you say, there's a vowel hiding in there somewhere. I'll take a vowel for, what, $400? Something like that. And so they came up with 22 consonants plus the vowels, and gave that back to the Phoenicians, who gave it to the Greeks. And that's why we write in all the Latin world with that alphabet. Actually, the Hebrews were the one that gave us our English, Roman, Latin alphabets. Okay. Now, the only reason I know that, I've been working on that for 2 weeks for a tank article. Been driving into all this thing about the scripts and all this stuff. Mind-numbing stuff. Okay. So now let's go up the hill. Let's look and see. You can see how beautiful this plain is here. Let me drop our altitude from 60,000 feet to 20,000. See, this is still down south. This is that desert. This is the Negev. This is where the Bedouin lived in the Old Testament. This is where Amalek, the slave trading raiders, they would come through here because nobody would want to live there. They'd come through and they'd raid the towns up north, stealing people, plundering them, and then selling them in the slave trade over in the coastal cities. Okay, it's difficult to fight these people. They didn't have cities. There was no fortifications. They'd run. I mean, they were good at what they did, you know. And that was part of... But they were also just atrocious what they did. They got wind that Israel had left Egypt at the Exodus, okay? So they leave Exodus, 1.6 million people roughly, somewhere in that neighborhood, leave Exodus, and they're moving through the wilderness, or just south of this, up here. And the Amalekites, always opportunistic, said, well, you know, I bet some of them don't move as fast as the others. Some will be like the hyena. I'm going to follow them and pick off the slow, the weak. And that really made God mad. Really made God mad. And that's what they did. They picked off the weak. They would have killed the ones that they couldn't sold into slavery. But the children that were traveling with the older folk that couldn't move real fast, they would make good slaves, fetch a good price. And so they were just, I mean, you know, this is really bad stuff. And so God says, when you get into the land, I want you to take them out. Just totally take them out. You give them 400 years to come around. He waits and he waits and he waits. And some of them become Israelites. I mean, there are people in Amalekites that fight for David and things of this type in here. But he says, that culture's got to go. And you give them a warning, let them all get out. that I'm going to end that kind of terrorist at a nation level, slave trading level. I mean, there were very few nations that were that bad in the world, but they would live in this particular area down here. And you can see the mountain there. You can see the reliefs, right? You can see that. And then all of a sudden, wham, it turns fertile. See? And that's where the road broke. In other words, the road that would come from Egypt, see, would come along the coastal range area where you had access to supplies and things of this type. And then it could break out into this beautiful plain area if it needed to. And a lot of Israel agriculture is done there. There's Ascalon. That's one of the five Philistine cities. Gaza. There's Gaza. But there were five cities of the Philistines that were such a problem, remember, for Saul, David, and not for Solomon actually had them confined to their area. They were fierce maritime sea peoples, very effective. Egypt was afraid of them. Egypt writes about the destruction that they're wreaking up in Israel. So when we keep going up here, we're going to come up to those northern mountains. See, there's coastline, actually Ashdod, that's the one of the five. Jamnia. See, there's that big city of Tel Aviv. And then if we keep going, we're going to start running into those mountains that, you know, here we get into our mountain range where Megiddo is going to start showing up. Because one of our big ports right here should be Megiddo. This should be one of those passes. They're coming up the way, so Megiddo should be one of these little dots. So there's facing north. Here's that beautiful plain, Armageddon Plain over here. That's Megiddo that guards this pass. You can see this little road that goes through there. So that guards that pass into this the plain of Esdraelon. And then our next thing to do is to turn right. And then you'll recognize that this is the shot that we had in the slides. Right? So like up here is Nazareth on top of this mountain. And down here is Sepphoris. And this will be Cana over here. And these are the valleys, and they'll be Capernaum. So that was where we were. Now, a lot of the activity that occurred in this world was up and down the Jordan. Look back at the Dead Sea. See it over there? And there's the Jordan Valley. And the Jordan River right now is the size of Deer Creek. It's just tiny because they bleed all the water off for agriculture and industrial uses now. But it was very large earlier, and it fed the whole plain. And at flood tide, it was, you know, it was a miracle for Joshua to take the people across at flood tide. But right now, it's a very, very sort of small city. But what we, I mean, a small area. But what we're going to do now is fly down it. Okay, see it in the distance there? So what we're going to do is move over a little bit. We're going to actually get down a little bit further to, say, 3,000. And I'll just have to steer it a little bit. See, this is the beautiful Jordan Valley. On the left is Syria and Jordan. On the right is, that's the Jezreel Valley that came out there. Here are the northern hills of Samaria, right? I over here is Jerusalem. You can see it there. And you see there's a crisscrossing of roads. This is the dry Judean wilderness. So we're at 3,000 feet above. So you can see they've done a lot with it. You know, but it gets drier as it gets further. The sea has shrunk. It's gotten smaller over the years. The area has gotten, because it has no outlet and doesn't have much inlet. Okay, because everything that's moisture over there, they capture and put to good use. And it goes down. The rate of it dropping slows as the salt concentration gets higher. So it can't always go. But if you see this little bright little area down here at the bottom, see this? It's almost like sea blue. What Jordan and Israel do, and Egypt, they all cooperate on this. This is a plant for getting mineral salts out of the sea. They get billions of tons of potash, different medicinal things, and that's part of the plant and the areas for creating that. Okay? All right. Now, we're going back to Galilee now, for our last two slides of this. We're up in Sepphoris. So we're actually in our text. And I just highlighted the text for you on Sapphoris. We didn't read through it all because I didn't want to cover it all. But we saw this city right here, Sapphoris. This is a city that's not mentioned in the New Testament. Okay, but it's the largest city in Galilee. It's built by Herod the Great and then rebuilt by his son Herod Antipas. It's about 2.5 miles from Nazareth, and at the time Jesus is a young boy, they're rebuilding that into one of the ornament of Galilee, as one historian called it. So there's a good chance that during that building, Joseph and perhaps some of the other James and Jude and these dudes would have gone down there to help Dad. Jesus was the oldest, of course, so he would have started apprenticing at around 10, 12 years of age. They probably would have gone to Sapphoris and helped in the construction work there. Scholars point out that Sapphoris had a lot of Jewish people in it, but it was a Gentile city. It was a non-Jewish city. There were all kinds of Romans in there and just regular old folk in there. And some of them look and say, well, maybe that explains why Jesus was so comfortable around this. You know, he was certainly comfortable around the Jews, but. But when he's talking to people up here, the Roman centurion invites him and says, come to my house, heal my kid. Jesus doesn't say, well, no, you're unclean. No, he starts going there. It's like he was comfortable with these people and knew what they did. We talked about some of the terminology he used. So Sapphoris is a source of where Jesus would have seen the whole world. Greeks, Romans, Syrians, everybody would have gone through Sapphoris, around Sapphoris, and traded. He would have seen the grandeur of the theater. He would have seen starving people. He would have known there were two or three messianic revolts in Sapphoris. There's a good chance he knew some of the people that were killed by the Romans that were supporting a false Messiah. So all of that would have been part of his upbringing. And Sapphoris, we had two slides on Sapphoris. Remember there's a shot of it. Sapphoris means a bird, and the rabbi said it's because it's perched up on a hill. And so you see it's above the land just a little bit there. John had pointed out in a conversation we had that there was a tradition that Mary's parents were from there, St. Anne and Joachim. Were from Sapphoris. There are also traditions. They're also from Nazareth and Bethlehem, of course. But there's monasteries and stuff like that there that commemorate that. We looked at a closer view where you can see the Greek theater. Well, here's the Greek theater. You see it built into the side of the rock. Built into the side of the rock there. Carved into the stone. They did stone masonry work there. There's a fortress there. We looked at here where they were excavating. These are squares where they're excavating actual houses and things of this type that people lived in. Okay, and then we're through with our intro. How about that? Look, it was only an hour. Well, we used to say, Josephus said it was a town of 1,600 to 2,000 people. Okay, but it looks more like it's 400 to 700. I mean, it's very, very small. And we're going to look at houses now, what they looked like in those days. So you see, because it was built on the side of a hill, but it would still be very small. Even up to 1600, there you might not be able to, feed a family of six as a carpenter without doing outside work in, around the area. Now, he was a carpenter, but the word is also can mean artisan, stone cutter. It could have been a jack of all trades kind of thing. A lot of opportunities. A lot of kind of work could have come his way. You'll see from the architectural reconstructions of houses here that there was a lot of places where they could have worked. The Israelites used a particular form of a house called a four-room house. Everything was laid out with four rooms. Israelites developed what's called a four-room house, and they were the only people that did this for the longest time. And the four rooms are like, in this diagram, I've drawn them. It's long. You can see the lady, so you can see the scale. But this would be room number one, room number two, room number three, and there was a fourth one that went traverse across the back. But they would break each one of those rooms up into sub-rooms if they wanted to. But every situation, Israeli house after the Iron Age looked like this. You know, with some modifications, the richer ones have more rooms and things of this type. So here's you see how big that is. There's another one that they found. You'll notice it's got that room one is broken up into a it's got pillars. So instead of a solid wall, there's the pillars there. That's where they would have kept animals, for example. If they kept animals inside, it'd be right in there. The ground floor, most of these had a second story we'll talk about. The ground floor was over here would be the cistern. That'd be where you have the courtyard often was not enclosed, roofed, so you could cook there. So you'd have a fire out there. Okay, but the ones downstairs were mostly for storage and work. So you would do certain types of work down there. And the middle room is this, the middle room is the courtyard in this particular case. And you can see it here where perhaps they've, I don't know if they've staged this or not, but the cistern's like right over here. See that? It's built up a little bit. And the cistern was a hole dug and plastered so it would hold water, be waterproof. Okay? And so you'd still have to go to the well sometimes to fill up the cistern. But this was the basic layout of the house. Now, when we get to looking at reconstructions, now there's one, and you slept on the second floor, okay, away from the animals and other things, okay? But you see the little courtyard, it's very small. It's real small. This is sort of large compared to those last two that we looked at, actually, okay? But there's the courtyard. There's some dude standing in the courtyard. You have ladders instead of stairs, unless you were wealthy. Okay, you had ladders up to the roof, and here's somebody doing cooking work up on the roof. Not cooking, but like food prep. So, like you would do the flax and the grain, you know, where you do sometimes you'd thrash the wheat on top of this roof, and then you would throw it up in the air because of the wind that came off the Mediterranean would then separate the wheat from the chaff, and it'd blow this away. Rabbinic law required you to have a parapet, the Old Testament law said you had to have a little lip around this thing, sort of like a little fence, so nobody would fall off and you'd be charged with homicide. Okay? So that put a real legal incentive on, you know, you building this out to building spec, to code. Okay? But you see the entrance, that's where they would sleep up there at the top. These are wooden cross beams. Here's another one where we've got, this one looks like it might be enclosed, but I don't know why they'd be cooking with it there. I'm not sure they are, but there you can see the donkeys in the stable, right? And you go upstairs and there's the sleeping mats. There's a loom, somebody's weaving there on the second floor. There's also a slat up to the very roof in this particular case. And this person is plastering. They would put thatch across, you know, wood, thatch, and then plaster. And you are constantly having to replaster the thing, like we do today, I guess. But you were being held up by the little beams and things of this type. So there's, you see the lady with the cistern, right? See, she's fetching water out of that. This will be a storeroom over here. I can't tell whether that's supposed to be a fire or not. Not sure exactly what that is. But there you see they've got pillars there, right, instead of a solid wall, while some of the others have solid walls. Now here's a more wealthy one. This is a lot larger. What's interesting is, wait a minute. You can see it's still a four-room house, see? One, two, three, four. See? But they've expanded a little bit on the side, a little bit out there. See what I'm saying? Okay? And you can see the various activities that are going on there. Here's again our cattle, right? Some cattle, farm animals are there. Here, men are doing some kind of decision making or something like that. Here's a cutaway. Let's tell what they're doing up there, you know. It doesn't look like they're sitting on mats and pontificating. They look like, you know, like they're speaking, you know, from Sinai or something of this type. But here's another, the ubiquitous roller. Here's the cooking, here's the kitchen, you got pots. Now, the only thing that's sort of questionable about this is that you didn't use shelves out. You didn't have shelves that came out. We'll look at it in a minute. What they were all were insets. And we'll look at that in just a minute. But you can see here's where the Last Supper kind of room is on that hall there. There are beds up here. You can see it's raised. It's a little bit higher than the ground floor. Well, there's some insets right there, see? Insets there. There's somebody doing food prep. Could be figs, could be olives, any stuff like that. Here's a work room. Okay. Here's somebody constantly painting and stuff and building the wall. That's a very large one. Okay. Now, there are some that are much larger than this. The rich folk had manors, not four-room houses. Okay. So they had a lot of stuff to work with. So here's a reconstruction of one. They had this city of Nazareth Village, I think it's called over there, where they built it to be as close as possible to the ancient Nazareth. So this would be that middle room, that courtyard, see? And so this would over here be wall to room one. This would be wall to room three. There's a stairway going up. There's the thatch, right, on the roof. You'd either sleep there or you'd have other activities up there. The upstairs also was for leisure. Now, the courtyard was the common room, and that's where you did everything from playing, having fun, shooting the fat, campfire stories. You know, it was a recreational area as well as a cooking. Now, here's a common room that's thatched. Okay, so that middle room, this one is thatched. The windows are this area or smaller. There are not large windows there. You need all the support. Cooling was done. They were placed high. A lot of times they're a lot higher. That's a higher than normal room in this reconstruction. Normally they're placed higher. They're about like that just to let the air vent. So the air would come in the front of the courtyard. Right? You would build it there to try to let that wind that's coming in off the Mediterranean come in there and blow out these vents. So you could achieve ventilation. For the ancient world, that was pretty significant given that, because you had a constant breeze going through that. But you see there's an inset, right? That's like the shelving that was into the wall. You would get one piece of stone and put it across and prop it up with these two. This is all mud brick, right? So you'd need stone to keep the thing from crumbling and falling in. Those would also be the lintel over the doorpost, things of that type. There's the little bench. They didn't have chairs. You know, they sat on the floor, they sat on pallets, and they sat on these very, very low benches. But generally, the benches were for storage anyway. You'd just keep them up above insects and things of this type, a little table. If you remember in the Mel Gibson, The Passion, in that story when he's doing a carpenter, he's a carpenter, Mary's there, he's a young adult, about to start his ministry. He's out there building a table, and he comes to show his mom. You know, he's 30-something, just to take a point in the story. He comes to show his mom this new table he built. Well, it's a normal table. It's a table like that. And people didn't use tables like that. At the Last Supper, you know, the table's like, you know, down here. Right? And you lay down, and the table is not, you know, that, and she says, nobody's going to use that. It's too tall. He said, someday they will. Yeah, I mean, cheesy prophetic little reference there. Someday they will. You know, it's a cute little story, but totally useless in that kind of context, right? But it was all done lower, you know, everything was done down there. You even slept on pallets and things of that type. I think I've got... Now, here's a variation on that. If you were not in the village, you might pool your resources with somebody else. Right, so here's a little village compound that's got two four-room houses, right, two-story houses. But notice it's not open, right, because you don't need it open because you've got this area, right? You got your fence going around here. You got a vineyard there. You got the kids playing in the yard, chasing the dogs, etc. Right? You got fire over here. There's somebody throwing the wheat and the chaff up there, perhaps. Bedding up here, storage, and so you would go in, and the fence is not big enough to keep an army out, but it's big enough to keep your animals in. So you don't have to necessarily allocate all the room for any larger animals that you have. Okay, so that's a village. That'd be like a little village. You're not village, just out in the countryside, and you just partner with the person you graduated from high school with, you know, I mean, that you were good buddies with, right? All right, here's another combat. Here's a condominium, okay? So we got 2 4-room houses put together, sharing an internal wall, a shared courtyard with a staircase, a central entrance. But the reason that's in there is because of those suckers. That's a fortress. That's to protect you, see? And so you were pooling your resources there, okay, for protection of things of this kind. This would be a wealthier family to be able to afford towers and things of this kind. But look how small it is, though. See, this is still a small little thing. You know, that big one we had was, I bought it at a tourist shop that was telling us how good life was in the biblical time. You know, the real ones where we dig up are, you know, little bitty things, okay? But different kind of modifications. So the last slide is Nazareth. So given you've got 4 rooms to work with, if you were going to build a city on the side of a hill, okay, the second story or one of the rooms might be oriented to be higher, like a split-level home, and you could come in it from the height or from below, right? So you see a number of these that have descending, you know, that are built like this, where you could enter it from the walkway coming through here or from below and still, you know, get where you needed to go. So building architecture on the hills, everything was built on the hill. You normally tried to build on one side of the hill, so you were only visible from one direction. Okay. Nazareth was built on 3 sides of a hill. Now, Nazareth, original Nazareth probably was only on 2 sides. Okay, so it had visibility. It's high up enough it can see what's coming, and it ain't big enough to warrant a lot of troublemaking. But the modern city of Nazareth now is just, you know, got, 60,000 people sprawling all over everything. You can't see anything that looks original. So, all right, so that's our, I just wanted to show you the houses thing. So you can see when Jesus goes into Peter's house and heals his mother-in-law, which is one of the things we do at Capernaum, you'll see his house is 3 times the size of just a regular house. I mean, he's got a really nice house, and they're apparently doing pretty well. Okay, so let's go now to the syllabus. We are now on, we're going to start page 5. On page 5, I've got a, if you look down there, this is still background. So background number 1 was Sepphoris. We had the first background was Sepphoris, that big city. Jesus grew up around that, learned a lot there. The next one is Herodium and the Bethlehem to Nazareth migration. If you remember from the Nativity stories, Joseph and Mary live in Nazareth, but they are from, at least one of them is from Bethlehem, of the tribe of Judah, David, of the line of David. So they have to go back from Nazareth to Bethlehem. That's where Jesus is born, okay? Then they flee the ruler. They go down to Egypt. Right? And when they come back, it looks like they were intending to go back to Bethlehem, where they have land and they have inheritance rights and things of this type. But an angel warns them in a dream, says Archelaus is crazy and he's the guy that's in charge there, so go up to Nazareth. And so that's how somebody from Bethlehem starts at Nazareth and ends at Nazareth. And I have my speculation, and I carefully qualify as to why that's the case. We do know from pottery that there was a mass migration of people from Bethlehem to Nazareth, okay, prior to the rebuilding period, okay, back at Herod the Great. The pottery samples, working materials that were unique to Bethlehem, style, things of this type, show up there. I suspect that it had to do with this Herodium thing. That little picture, that thing looks like a, you know, molehill. That is built by Herod the Great with questionably ethnic labor. Let's put it this way. These would have been low-rent soldiers, mercenaries from the other side. They're working in the desert here. It's at the edge of the desert. This thing is 2 miles from Bethlehem. And they probably tried to conscript Joseph's family and all the people to go do this. And so the logical way of avoiding the draft is move to Canada. Right, so they moved to Galilee. Right, so they're up in Galilee, and that's why they still have property down there, and then work becomes plentiful there at Nazareth. So, we needed to cover that in terms of background. And now we get to Bethlehem. To Galilee. Now, Galilee was that whole area, remember, around the Sea of Galilee. Capernaum's in it, Cana, Nazareth, Sepphoris. That's all in that area. Megiddo, that's all in Galilee. Okay, so we need to know a little bit about Galilee. And so I put together some material on Galilee. So let's look at page 6. Actually, let me do the Bethlehem right quick, though. I don't think I put anything of Bethlehem in. Did I? I think I got one thing on it. Yeah. The main thing I just show you here on Bethlehem right quick. Here's Jerusalem, the city up here. And Bethlehem's down here. I've already talked about how the mountain ranges. Even a monkey learns to duck. Friend. There's a road that runs here. As you can barely see. Comes up through Jerusalem, goes up here. Goes through Bethlehem down to Hebron. And this is one of the old, old Israeli things. It's called the Way of the Patriarchs. So, and Abraham comes into the land, he goes down to Hebron. First he stops up at Shechem and does some business up in Samaria. And he comes down, and this is a famous road connecting Bethlehem and Jerusalem. Now we're looking at, here's Bethlehem. Of course, it's all built up now. And here's the Way of the Patriarchs, basically. Okay, Jerusalem is, we're looking at it sort of from Jerusalem, from the north. Okay, there's that mountain over there, Herodium. It's like 2 miles here, right, from where the Church of the Nativity, which is one of the possible birthplaces of Jesus. Oh, I should have mentioned. Remember where you had the four-room house and had the little stable where the animals were? If you had any options, you built that wall against a mountain, right? So you could use the materials of the mountain. And especially if there was a cave in the mountain that you could expand the livestock area. And so we find a number of houses that have the cave there. And the oldest tradition we have of where Jesus was born is in a cave. But the story is mixed with cave and manger. And when you put it together, it's... The manger, of course, is a feeding trough of animals. Right? It would have been in that room down at the north end, the east end of that. Would have been right there. And that feeding trough could have just as easily been in the cave of a family that was large enough to hold Mary and Joseph. Remember? When they came in, the town was swollen with people. If there was a large migration out, and they all got to go back for Caesar, Augustus, you know, roll call vote. You know, you stay where you could. Right, among family, hospitality, right? So that would be a large family gathering, and so they may themselves have to stay in the cave, you know, in terms of housing instead of up where people slept. But one of our earliest traditions is that he's born in a cave, one says he's in a manger in the stable, and then you realize, well, those may be the same thing actually, the way the archaeology works out. So, Church of the Nativity is one of the possible birthplaces of Jesus. Rachel's tomb. Rachel is one of the parents of the 12 tribes. So we have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob becomes Israel. Jacob marries Leah, and Rachel, and two other of their handmaids, sort of like concubines, that kind of thing. But handmaids were a little different than concubines. Well, Rachel was the beloved wife, first choice wife, so to speak, of Jacob. He worked 7 years as to earn the dowry thing, the bride price, and on the wedding feast got tricked and took the older sister Leah, and then had to work another 7 years for the younger one that he did the whole deal for. Well, Rachel dies in one of these journeys, and Rachel's tomb is there. If you keep going down the edge of the Road of the Patriarchs, about another, I want to say 10 miles, is Hebron, which is where Abraham, the traditional site of Abraham's and Sarah's tombs are, and that's where they spent a lot of their time in the city of Hebron. And that's why it's so famous all over the world. It's in Palestinian control. It's over in the West Bank now. And so when you go there, you know, that's part of the tour is through the West Bank. And so, but it's right on that road of the patriarchs, and it's very, very close. And like I say, the field gathers there, the mountains close up right there. Okay, now, back to Galilee. And so that's a shot of Galilee. You see where Nazareth is there on the chart. All right, background of Galilee, page 6. Galilee, taken from the Hebrew Galil, which means ring or circle, hence a district or region. This is the regional name of the part of North Palestine, which was the scene of Christ's boyhood and early ministry. The origin of the name is uncertain. It occurs occasionally in the Old Testament, Joshua 20, 1 Kings, and notably in Isaiah 9:1. Now, this is a key verse. Nevertheless, there shall be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, this is Isaiah in the Old Testament, between 722 and 586. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and those lands were part of Galilee. The 12 tribes, if we go back to that chart, you'll see them right smack dab in the middle, over in this section, actually. So we're roughly in there. And a little higher than that. Zebulun's a little higher than that, I think. But in the future, God will honor Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea. That's the name of that trade route, via Maris, along the Jordan. And the Jordan also goes up there into Galilee. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. And, of course, is a key background that's an understanding of Jesus' ministry. Why he spent so much time in Galilee was because nobody liked them. It was a land living in darkness. And when Isaiah does it, when Isaiah's writing about Galilee, Galilee was the first part of Israel that was ripped off by Assyria. They were ripped off, you know, they were taken away and they were resettled by just low life. Right? And so everybody looked down on Galilee, the people that were left, looked down on Galilee. And that's the people who were distressed. The latter reference probably recalls the region's history. It originally formed part of the lands allocated to the 12 tribes, but owing to the pressure from peoples farther north, its Jewish population found themselves in a kind of northern salient, which is just an isolated element that everybody can see. Not to be confused with saline solution. Surrounded on three sides by non-Jewish populations, the nations. Under the Maccabees, the Gentile influence upon the Jews was so strong that the latter were actually withdrawn south for half a century. It was so bad, it was so pagan that they moved south. The Jews moved south. Thus, Galilee had to be recolonized, and this fact, together with its diversity of population, contributed to the contempt felt for the Galileans by the southern Jews. So the Jews of the south in Jerusalem and Judea, they looked down on the people from Galilee in more ways than one. Not literally. Remember, they're on the high point of the mountains. Galilee's down this beautiful, lush plains. So you can even tip your head down and still be looking up, you know, looking down at them. So they looked down on them because of all this mixed population and mixed history and all this kinds of stuff. Second bullet, major trade route from Damascus to Egypt is called the Way of the Sea. From Egypt, this enters Galilee from the southwest through the pass of the Wadi Hara at Megiddo. So Megiddo's going to be in this picture down in here. Way down in here. Somewhere there's a range here that goes here that's not actually in our shot. This is the port of Ico Ptolemais there. So it goes in here, it splits. It comes in here, as we pointed out, it splits into these three, you know, to Damascus. And the other one goes down to Beth Shean in this area. What else do we need there? All right, look at the last bullet down there. General description. The region of Galilee is approximately 60 miles long from north to south. And 30 miles wide from west to east. So that's only like a 30-mile piece there. So on the scale, that's like 30 miles. Okay. Galilee contains the coolest, most picturesque, and lush mountainous district. The terrain is diversified, containing volcanic and limestone hills with alluvial fertile plains. It has been compared with portions of the Carolina and Virginia Piedmont. The entire region is watered by springs. Heavy mountain dew and an annual precipitation of about 25 inches. It just anything grows there. They can make crops, and they grow on the hillsides. You can grow small fruits and vegetables on the hillside. Your main crops will be barley, wheat, you know, things of that type that would be down in the plains if you could. But you would grow all your accessory vegetables, so to speak, on the hillsides. Now, this next page, page 7, is just a summary of things I had on the think tank where I put all the research in just a couple of bullets. So this will take us through the background of Galilee right quick. First bullet, the population was concentrated in small towns rather than big cities. So we don't have a lot of big cities. Nazareth is a small town. Sepphoris is a big city. Tiberias over on the lake that Herod built there, right up there, is a big one, and we're out of big ones. Everything else is small. Cana, Capernaum, Bethsaida, all these things are small ones. The vast majority of Jews in Jesus' lifetime in Galilee, Transjordan, and Judea lived in small towns, not in the large cities such as Tiberias and Jerusalem. Second bullet. The populace would have been predominantly Jewish in religion. The Maccabees, 1st century B.C., forced all the Gentiles in Palestine to either leave the country or convert to Judaism. You can bet they were very zealous and very sincere converts to Judaism. You can see this. It's like the Chinese general that, 1700s, something like this. Chinese general converts to Christianity and he baptizes his army with a water hose, fire hose. They baptize his army so they all become Christians. And one fell soup. Just that simple, isn't it? Just that simple, you know. It remains true, however, that the Jews... third bullet. The Jews in the villages were generally alienated from the Jews living in the cities. Okay? It remains true, however, that the Jews living in the towns of Capernaum and Chakaria... How do you say that? Chakaria. I've never actually had to pronounce that. Were alienated from the Jews in the Greek cities of Sepphoris and Tiberias. And so there's already... animosity between the country folk and the city folk, okay, in this deal. Galilee, according to Josephus, had 204 villages organized into five regions, toparchies, which reported into Herod Antipas, whose headquarters were in the city of Tiberias. The region was densely populated, and you can understand because it was so lush. You could make a living there. It was a very peaceful area. I don't know if I've got this. Yes, I think I do. Very peaceful area during the time of Jesus' life, actually. The capital of Galilee was Tiberias, although the only other large city, Sepphoris, constantly battled with it for the place of administrative preeminence. They were both being either rebuilt or refurbished, adding to the tax burden of the area. Now, if you were taxed to support some building program, somebody wanted these, you know, they weren't settled with a four-room house. They wanted a 14-room house. You know, one of those kind of things. And you're being taxed. The only thing you actually have when you can't pay your taxes, guess what? Your land. And so you lose your land in this process to the government. The government makes land grants to its friends. And so you are now become a tenant farmer. And so when Jesus goes out and says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the land," that means that says those that trust the Lord will get their land back. Their land. Okay. The capital cities were predominantly Jewish in population, but were thoroughly Hellenistic. That means they had theaters, they had Greek plays, they had maybe Greek races, the gladiators, which were just the rabbis really hated, all this bloody stuff. In organization and administration, Herod built Tiberias on a graveyard. See, that is so anathema to a strict Jew. And used animal figures as decorations. You're not allowed to do that in Jewish faith up to that time. Both practices were anathema, a curse to strict Jews, and forced Jews to live there in the city of Tiberias. But he compensated them with land grant. That softened the blow ever so, like when they got a real nice corner lot over there. Granted, it was on the cemetery, but it was a nice lot with good view of the sea and everything like that. Sepphoris was a few miles northwest of Nazareth, had all the features of a Hellenistic city, including a theater, hippodrome, and temples. That'd be pagan temples. Although it was a priestly city populated by wealthy Jewish landowners who favored the Romans during the Jewish Wars. Hellenism had made considerable impact on Galilean trade,
political organization, language, and commerce. Now, let me just comment. We're fixing to run into our first, when we get into our stories of Capernaum, they're going to deal with a Roman centurion who's guarding the road and a tax gatherer who's a customs official. So these things are going to be, going to come together in the life of Jesus as he's ministering to people in these specific jobs. The regular pilgrimage to Galileans to Jerusalem demonstrates the religious and cultural loyalty. Okay, their bald print. Their loyalty to Jerusalem did not imply their acceptance of the full range of Pharisaic demands. For example, the rural populace simply did not observe their purity laws. The rabbis made all these laws. You can't do this. You can't do this. This is unclean. If you pour water from this and this, it's all unclean. You know, they got all these things. And whereas the populace would admire them for their zeal, they'd say, that's not for me. I worship God in a simpler, more personal way. Or something of this type, you know. So they wouldn't go there.
The last two bullets, exports were mainly the salted fish and pottery and oil. And imports normally came through that sea port up here. Would come in this way. Beer came from Babylon, Egypt, number of foods, Bithynia, mackerel, cheese. And Tyre had the purple dye that's so famous. Let's do this last one. It's 322, but let me just do the bold here. The kingdom of Israel, including the region of Galilee, was assimilated by Assyria. Remember I told you about it. It was the first one carried off by the Assyrians. Galilee of the nations probably refers to the mixture of Jews and Gentiles then living in the area. Okay. The next bold one is key to our period. When Herod came to his throne in 37 B.C., this is Herod the Great, a period of peace and prosperity came to Galilee, which continued until the banishment of his son Antipas in A.D. 4. So that covers the entire life of Jesus, that this land is relatively peaceful, and the only threats that Jesus would have walking around are from his friends, his family, the other Jews, and Herod, and one of the Herods, and only because he's superstitious. Okay, so it was a good time for these people of life, and the people that were in darkness have seen a great light. The Messiah is going to step into their world, grow up among them. They're going to watch him. For good or ill, they're going to grow up with him. John the Baptist is one of his cousins. John the Baptist is a little bit older than he is. You know, so everybody's kin there. You know, everybody knows, and that's for good or ill, you know, because when we see him going to Nazareth and he reads, he says, we know this guy, why should we take him seriously? You know, he's a local. He's not a special visiting dignitary. And we'd pay attention to a real king. But because they knew him, it's familiarity breeds contempt kind of thing, or apathy or something like this. And, of course, that's a message, obviously, for us, because, I mean, especially in the Western world where it's common. We're exposed to the claims of the Lord, his love. We hear it all the time. You know, we could be anesthetized to it, you know. But if we lived like in a persecuted country, right, where to mention it, to say, yeah, I am beloved of the Lord. He loves me. You take a bullet, right? You have a real pure folk there. They really know what they believe. And here we got something like this. You got a religious community. They're all doing the little thing. They're making their pilgrimages. They're doing their things. And then when God steps right in among them, the only ones that seem to catch him are the ones that are honest enough about their need. Right? The uses of the world. So, okay, we got a little bit ways in there. So let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we do thank you that you broke into history, that you just came looking for us. That you didn't just leave us down here just fumbling around and trying to make do and trying to figure out maybe this is the right thing to do. Maybe this isn't. I don't know what to do. How should I live? What makes a difference in life? And you came after us in your love and your goodness for us. And you walked among us and shared with us, Lord, in this land. And I pray, Father, that as we look further into these passages, and as we just reflect upon your dealings with Israel that we reviewed tonight, that we would remember that you are always there. You're just right there, ready to be a refuge in times of trouble, to be a strength, and to be a delight partner. Someone to rejoice in something we do that's beautiful. Something that someone does to us that's good. That you're right there to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep is what you told us to be. And that's like your heart. So may we be that this week for our closest people that we're close to, our loved ones, the people we come in contact with. But especially, may we draw closer to you. May your heart expand our hearts. May we recognize that you pick us up and carry us, that you have that shepherd's heart that you look for. So bless these people and bless them for the good week going forward, their eagerness to learn and refreshment and things of this type. And so keep us safe. And like I say, may we walk closer with you because of this time we spent tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.